Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour, December 8th, 2016. Interesting stories tonight. I'll be talking a number of topics about Russia, about the comet, 45P Honda Marcos Parusakova is the Russian term there. So anyway, three discoveries of this comet. But anyway, we'll have a somewhat close encounter with Earth on February 11th, but that's not the story. And as you can imagine, a lot of people out there in the hype media would want to pick that date, but that's not the date that will be interesting. Let's just put it that way. It's not on a collision course with Earth. It comes within a 0.1 astronomical unit. So that's about 20 million miles. So not exactly what you'd call close. And it's a small comet, so not like the end of the Earth scenario, nothing like that. But some interesting issues, so I'll be talking about that. Just a couple comments about the political situation. And Trump being named Time Person of the Year warrants a bit of commentary. And interestingly enough, on the cover of Time, they have him sitting in a chair looking presidential. They call him president. So that's pretty much everybody has discounted this recount thing. And I could go into some of the details, but I'd rather not waste time. But the Time magazine says he's the president of the divided states of America. And I like Trump's response. He said, well, it was divided before I got here. He's going to try and fix it. But at any rate, that what does have to do with science is draining the scientific swamp of Washington. And so this is something that is very necessary. It's as necessary to drain the scientific swamp in Washington as it is the regular political swamp in Washington. So with that in mind, I receive the American Geophysical Union newsletters, and I've spoken many times at given presentations at the American Geophysical Union meetings, which brings in sometimes as many as 20,000 scientists from around the world for the meetings. There's the semi-annual meeting, and then there's the annual meeting, which is the big one. But yeah, I've presented many times. But they are very, very, let's say, dependent on government funding, and all the scientists in this genre. When I used to go to meetings, I would wear my badge very proudly, which said independent scientist. And all of the scientists there know me from way back, going back into the, well, I mean, even in 1979 to 81 when I was at Cornell, the word got out quickly that there was some guy who was publishing, who was in the face of NASA at Cornell. And also, I was giving presentations. Then I continued my scientific work, and literally everybody knew me. So I would go to a meeting, and people would look at my badge, and of course, they all had affiliations of NASA or Goddard Space Flight Center or the University of Maryland or John Hopkins University, or, you know, whatever it was, JPL, et cetera, and corporations, you know, Gulf South Research Institute, whatever it was. And so I had a young Oriental guy. I don't know if he was from Japan or China. I think he was from Japan. He gave his very first talk at the American Geophysical Union meeting, and he looked very nervous, and he was talking about comets. So I came up to him afterwards, and I asked him a question. And he was very nervous because he didn't have a clue how to answer. And so at any rate, then he looked down at my badge, and he goes, "Ah, so what is independent scientist?" And I looked at him, and I said, "Well, that means I don't take from anybody. So excuse my French," and that's what I told him. I also had a woman one time, and so I apologize for the brashness here, but there was a woman next to me at one of the American Geophysical Union meetings, and she had just gotten her PhD. She was working. She was older. She had raised her family, went back to school, got her PhD, and she was at the table next to me with there was the Goddard people there, John Hopkins Goddard people, and it was the talking about the discovery of X-rays in comets. And so she was part of the team there, and she looked at me and she said, what? Of course, everybody looks for your affiliation. Your name is almost less important than your affiliation. And so, independent scientist, what does that mean? And I told her that that means that I fund my own research. I don't take government money. I'm not involved in any government, funding programs, etc. And she just couldn't imagine this. She just could not imagine that someone would fund their own research. And how would you possibly do that? How could you live without the government? And so anyway, back to the idea of American Geophysical Union, or not just them, National Science Foundation, National Institute of Health, many, many other agencies where there's top-down funding of science on the planet. And the United States has far more dollars, or lots more money, let's put it that way, in investing in science than any other country. If you put all the other countries together, they wouldn't match, say, the budget of just the National Science Foundation alone. And then there's the Atomic Energy Commission and the Department of Energy. Oh my goodness, it just never ends. So these people are all dependent. These scientists are dependent on the swamp in D.C. So I got an email a couple days ago from the American Geophysical Union wondering about the future. So I wanted to just cover a few quotes here. The reason this is important, because it affects you out there, because, hey, buddy, ma'am, sir, and kids of the future, you're paying for this. You're paying for the free ride. And really, not very much good science comes out of all of this. Just briefly, okay, let me grab this here. Okay, this is from the head of one of the physics divisions within the NASA headquarters. It says, with the presidential transition and the expected change of senior NASA leadership, there is also uncertainty. And the uncertainty is in money. Now, yeah, the scientists depend on an annual basis for funding. And if you look at NASA, 95% of it is overhead. And the poor scientists are sitting down literally at the end of the food chain. Believe me, if I had this kind of money to spend on outer space, we would be on beyond Pluto by now. But NASA is a giant ship that doesn't know how to turn. And, the manned Mars mission in 30 years is going to chew up the vast majority of their money. So scientists working on science are just going to be, bottom feeders at best. Anyway, I just wanted to note something else. This is in the heliospheric physics groups, and they're talking about LWS, living with a star. And so they're talking about, this is a program. Living with a Star is a program to understand radiation in outer space. And they're trying desperately. They also have programs dealing with the Van Allen belts, trying to understand them. But this is all geared towards understanding how you can get human beings through the Van Allen belts and how you deal with all of the other radiation issues in outer space. So you have the National Geographic special on Mars. Everybody's going to Mars. And it looks like, to me, I've watched pieces of this, and I really can't even stand it to watch this, because it looks like a really modern Hollywood version, 2016 Hollywood version of Flash Gordon, which is the 1930s. I thought Flash Gordon was better, frankly. But the problem is they have all of these human encounters in the National Geographic Mars special, and, danger, with dust storms or whatever. But they never, never cover the real issue. And this real issue is why nobody ain't never going to go to Mars in any of these programs. It's called radiation. In my paid cast, by the way, my weekly paid cast, I have a special session that goes on in a regular session called Radiation and You. And some of the sessions I've talked about space radiation. One of them is called Space Radiation, What NASA Is Not Telling You. But at any rate, it's so important. Space is such an important factor in modern life. And it's just being wasted. The resources are just being horribly wasted. If I could become NASA head director for a day, believe me, things would change. And the scientists out there would all of a sudden love me as much as they hated me before. Because I would make sure that they could do their science, pursue their interests, without having to open up a book and pick the project that they want to work for that is top-down directed from some government program specification. No, it would be very different, believe me. We would also have a national registry where scientists could publish and own their own work and be receive recognition for their own work. It would be very different, believe me. Anyway, that's a long story. I don't have time to go into all of that right now. But NASA needs a real draining of the swamp. And it's very difficult to get Trump's ear. But at any rate, draining the swamp in Washington is very necessary. Just a couple brief announcements. Many people have asked me if I have heard if there's going to be a disaster of some kind. People are talking about the day after Christmas and in February and other days. And I have no information myself. I have absolutely zero information that would warrant fear or loathing about upcoming events. The comet I'll be talking about here in a minute, 45P Honda, Marcos, etc., is not an issue. There's no issue with that comet. There could be a potential of the meteor stream that accompanies the comet, but even that is probably well away from Earth. This is a relatively small comet. But once again, I'll be talking about that in a minute. There's also, I was on John Moore's show yesterday, a woman called in and she said, did you hear about the meteor that hit Russia? And I said, nope. So I said, I'll look into it. Well, anyway, it turns out that a meteor came in over Russia and blew up in the air. People just saw the light, a flash of light in the sky. As far as they know, nothing hit the ground, so this baby just evaporated in midair. And sometimes you find little pieces of meteorites and things like that when these type of things happen. But apparently, according to the Russian scientists that were taking this report, it was small, maybe 10 meters in diameter at most, vaporized, and that was the end of it. So that's the only news we have. There was no damage to speak of. I thought at first they might be mistaking it for the one that hit a lake outside of a town in Russia in 2013. But no, this was a separate event that happened yesterday morning. Just quickly also, Buzz Aldrin was vacationing at the South Pole and there was an emergency evacuation. They had to get him out of there. People have asked me, why is everybody going down there? John Kerry was down there. You got the ABC astronauts, the first three alleged astronauts to the moon going down there on vacation. I'm just not sure if they put palm trees down at the South Pole now. But somebody asked, also on John Moore's show yesterday, if this could be related to, say, all of them watching Nibiru. And I said, no. Right now is the worst time to be at the South Pole if you want to see anything astronomical because it's summertime. Literally, you got 24-hour sun there. So it's not exactly good telescope good telescope time there. So no, it's not that anybody's there looking through telescopes. That only happens from May to June. That's the best time. And then you see that part of the sky where the South Pole always points in that direction, but you're not going to get a glimpse of that because then you have eternal nighttime down there for a number of months. But that's in June, May to June, in that time frame, or possibly April to July, but certainly not now. So anyway, that's but the better possibility, and this I knew about a long time ago from working with the Russian scientists. They have been discovering, I don't know what it is, under the ice. They've been drilling down there over Lake Vostok, which is a massively large freshwater lake in Antarctica. It has a dome of ice over it and then 2 miles of ice sitting on top of that. They had discovered mastodons and other ancient life forms or whatever. And the reality is Antarctica within the last 10,000 years was not at the South Pole, whereas our North Pole now was not at the North Pole. The old North Pole used to be, and I explain this in my book, Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection. The old North Pole used to be north of the state of Michigan and what is now the province of Ontario. And I talk about this on radio shows. I talk about it in my book, Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection. And if you go to where the South Pole used to be over an island called McDonald Island down in the South Indian Ocean, way down there. You can find it on most globes will show McDonald Island. And so that's the old South Pole. And Antarctica was a temperate climate location on the planet. So at any rate, it would have had life. The old Phoenician map that Columbus had, the Perry Reese map, had the coastline of South America on it. And that's what Columbus was looking for. He was looking for a coastline, and of course he couldn't find it. And as he would have gone, it would have been on his left side, and what he discovered was the Americas, which was on his right side. So it was all backwards. He was looking for that coastline, and only after satellite photos using the penetration capability of satellites to see the coastline of Antarctica, they matched it up, and it matches the Perry Reese map perfectly. So that's a long story in itself. But that's my bet, that there's a lot of exploration going down there regarding what is actually down beneath the ice cap in Antarctica. And so, and I imagine being the superstars in the scientific community that the ABC astronauts are, that they got to go down there on a so-called vacation. But at any rate, that was my guess. That's a guess, educated guess, and I'm probably right. This is interesting. Education in Africa. Mark Zuckerberg and Bill Gates had contributed large sums of money to fund schools in Africa. Uganda just shut down all of those schools, and other countries have been following suit. Why? Because they're using the kids in vaccination programs, and they really don't know what else. They're using them as human experiments, and so the countries have been forced to shut down these programs. These people are pure evil. And one of the things that I would love to see Trump do is to use the antitrust laws to shut down these operations and open them up to competition. These companies are just too big. So Google and Facebook and, there's the whole Yahoo, the whole laundry list of other companies that literally have been funded by the CIA are just too big. They're just too big, and this is what you get. So anyway, Africa shutting down schools, which is really strange, because you would imagine that those countries are desperate for funding, for education, for the betterment of the children, but they're shutting them down because they're experimenting on the kids. Oh my goodness, it just doesn't get any worse than this. The term fake news, you're going to hear more and more of. Obama has been talking about this. I looked at MSNBC the other day, and they have articles. Here's an article from MSNBC, who is, I mean, talk about the king and queen of fake news. MSNBC, CNN, and I still have my note to put up on my webpage, the disinformation, standard media, what they call mainstream media. But they're starting to accuse alternative media of being fake news. And the quote was from MSNBC, "Most Americans believe fake news." No, most Americans are waking up that the established news media is the fake news. People are reading between the lines. They know BS when they see it. And partly due to, you know, at least a small contribution from this show and other shows, there are still Americans out there that just absolutely don't have a clue. But that's really changing a lot. And I think this last election was very indicative and of vast populations. And this, the way to see this is not from the phony election results that have been published, but looking at the county voting. Hillary Clinton won 57 counties out of 3,057. So there's no way on the planet she got the number of electoral votes that they say she got. Just a little commentary on the recount in Michigan, since this is a statistical, it's a mathematical process of recounting. Many, many of the precincts in Michigan could not be recounted because the seals on the voting ballot boxes, after they get done voting, they put all the ballots in boxes and then seal them. The seals had been broken on boxes, so they couldn't recount them. So the precincts where they found that, they couldn't recount. So the Michigan recount is really very sketchy. Getting back to this issue of fake news, so I'm sure I would be called fake news. you know, and a lot of the other, what you call alternative radio, are being called fake news. So there's literally a war on, and this has been going on for a long time. I've been involved in an information war regarding science literally all my adult career. It has gotten worse and worse and worse as time goes on. The science information given to the public is just over the top, top-down controlled. Anyway, it's important for people to really understand this, to understand the immense amount of bad information being dumped on you, the public. Here is a good example. Spaceweather.com seems to be promoting G-class flares now. Let me just explain. There's the G, M, and then the X-class flares. There's a hierarchy of flares that, and they go up by decimal or exponential levels. So a G-class flare is the lowest level. And now, because the sun is so quiet and has been for literally almost a decade now, they're trying to promote this idea that the sun could blow up and kill us all or take down the power grid. But the reality is the sun is so quiet, now they're getting excited over G-class flares. And absolutely absurd beyond belief. But there again, they have to keep this going, because if there's ever an event, I said, whether it's man-made, whether it's natural or whatever, they will pull the power grid and try and blame it on a false flag solar event. And with the upcoming couple of months here, everybody is expecting the Obamas and the other people in the background, the Soroses, the European bankers, to try and pull something. And along with that could be a power outage. So but the point is, there's no warrant for a natural solar-induced power outage. It's simply not in the cards. So if you see this, you know that somebody is pulling the switch. And I've given lectures on how to tell the difference between a real power outage and a real power outage caused by solar flaring, etc., a grid outage, and a fake one. It's very easy to tell the difference, as easy as telling meteorites or meteors from the rods from gods. They're very characteristic signals, signs that you can look at, and you know one from the other if you know what to look for. A Russian cargo rocket going to the space station blew up 190 kilometers up. Now, we've had, what, three or four of these in the past year? And one of them, when the last one was Elon Musk, SpaceX, that they were putting a payload going up to the space station. And that one, you could barely see it in the downrange cameras, but the payload blew up. Once again, on the Russian cargo, the payload blows up. And so these are being destroyed by some entity out there, probably the U.S. government. And I really don't, you know, it's hard to put a finger on something, but this is the third or fourth of these payloads that have blown up. Remember, one of them was on the launch pad, where it literally the payload blew up on the launch pad. So payloads don't blow up. You know, in all of the history of rocketry, you have rockets blowing up. You have mishaps where you have, during takeoff or, you know, up a certain distance, or like with the shuttle disaster, rockets blow up, but not the payloads. So something funny is going on here. There's a lot of funny business going on trying to get payloads up to the International Space Station. Just a quick commentary also about the poles. Now, the North and South Pole are quoted many times as measurements being made to say that they're losing ice. They're becoming smaller, and that's an indicator of global warming. Well, recent studies, and this has been going on for actually many years, the southern ice cap, if you look at it from above, if you took a satellite photo, of course, from a distance, then the southern ice cap is getting larger. But what they do is they'll go down, and it grows in some areas and it shrinks in others. So they've been going down to the areas that are shrinking and then say, look at global warming, it's shrinking. But there's another dimension to this, and that is that the south and north poles are growing vertically all the time. So you have to measure the volume, not simply the area as viewed from a satellite photo above. That's the lazy man's experiment. That's what we call a quick and dirty. You go, oops, look at it, lost a little area here. Oops, global warming, everybody send us money. That's what's been going on. But you also have to measure the volume, the overall volume, and these, of course, are cyclic. And also they change during the course of the year because you go into summer and winter at the poles. But it's very clear that the poles are growing increasing very much in size vertically, in addition to the voluminous content of water ice at the poles is growing. And now they've confirmed that in Antarctica, the actual extent of the ice cap, in other words, the picture that you take from satellite above, is growing also, throwing a monkey wrench into this idea of global warming. So they're still looking at this, the global warming scientists, but they won't give up the ship. They're going to go down with that ship because that's the international funding and it's the international political directive, because that is what is mainly the emphasis, the impetus to control water by the United Nations, by the other agencies and the bankers who control the federal government in the United States, etc. So the North and South Poles, once again, you have to do your homework. when you talk about global warming, you just can't talk about the temperature going up. I've given this example many times. You take two boxes of air, identical boxes, you put them side by side on a table, exact same temperature, exact same chemistry, proportionate of nitrogen, oxygen, water contents, etc., in each of the boxes, exactly the exact same temperature. In the thermodynamic sense, those are equivalent boxes. Now, do something. Raise the water content in one of the boxes. Put more water vapor in one of the boxes and keep them at the same temperature. There's more heat in the box with more water vapor. This is simple 101, you know, third grade chemistry. So you're talking about heat content. There's more heat content in one than the other, even though they have the same temperature. So temperature is not an indicator of global warming. Warming or climate change, and so what they're confusing is the term temperature, which is a measure of the energy in the box of the molecules bouncing around in there. Energy and temperature are related, but heat content also is related to this, but they're not talking about heat content. To do a thorough job, if you want to talk about global warming, you have to take measurements of all of the thermodynamic properties on Earth, including the ocean water, the air temperature. You have to take the humidity and other variations in structure of the air around the globe and put this into a massive database. And you have to have measurement points probably every mile in the atmosphere, in the ocean, etc., and then watch this and then coordinate that with the input from the sun, both the solar light input and the electrical input. And they don't even talk about the electrical input at all. So this is what you call, once again, a quick and dirty. And I learned that expression because I have seen professors in universities do this. They're trying to get a grant. They throw together a little experiment on a table. They get a measurement, and they go and they write up a report for funding, and they send it in, and they get the funding. And then the inspector comes and wants to see the experimental apparatus, and it's a little piece of junk on a table. And that's what they got, you know, a $2 million grant for, based on what is known as a quick and dirty. So the climatologists that favor global climate change or global warming or whatever the current trend is to call it this year, that's what they do. They stick a thermometer out the window. They go, oh, it's a little warmer today than it was yesterday. Oops, must be global warming. The reality is Earth is coming out of an ice age. And yes, the glaciers are melting. We're coming out of an ice age from in the past 10,000 years. Those glaciers were part of an ice age. We're not in an ice age anymore. And the sun is quiescent. It's at very low energy. And so right now we're actually in a cooling period. So the extent of the poles is actually growing. But at any rate, hopefully a lot of this really bad science will go by the wayside. The Earth depends minute by minute on energy from the sun. And you can prove this to yourself. It's not hard to do. Just wait for nighttime to come and watch the temperature of Earth drop 10 to 20 degrees. Wherever you are, it's going to drop that much, minimally. And so what that tells you is that when you come back around, the sun comes up in the morning, the Earth where you are heats up again. That's telling you that you depend on the sun on a minute-to-minute basis. Simple as that. So the idea that you driving your car up and down the road is going to create greenhouse effect, which they don't talk about anymore because it doesn't work, to imagine that that somehow is affecting global climate. I have a posting on my webpage showing the CO2 content of the world, and that's what they're talking about, the CO2 and the CO2 tax and carbon, all of this. NASA's map from satellite measurements shows the CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere. The biggest concentration of CO2 on the globe is above the Amazon jungle. No cars driving up and down the road there, believe me. And above New York City and Los Angeles and Hong Kong and Mexico City, you don't even see CO2. Not a drop. So it's a ruse. Global climate change science is a ruse. Simple, pure and simple. I should mention that if you want to get your 50th anniversary gold coin, Congress is going to mint, I think it's a gold coin, 1 ounce, the 50th anniversary of the moon landing. And maybe that's why those guys are down at the South Pole vacationing. I think I'd rather go to a Caribbean island or a nice white beach with palm trees. But there again, there's something else going on at the South Pole. And I think I'm right about the issue. But if you want to buy your 50th anniversary Congress minted coin, and I'm not sure if it's going to pass Congress. This is the House that passed this. So I don't know if we'll see if this gets through the Congress. But there again, this is not what Congress is supposed to be doing. I'm sorry. I think there's a lot more pressing issues on the planet than minting coins celebrating 50 years of the alleged moon landing. Okay, I'm going to talk about the comet. What is the real story about the comet? And what I've done here is I've drawn a timeline of this comet as it comes into the solar system. But first, let me explain a little bit about the comet. It's called 45P Honda Marcos Pajdusakova. And so at any rate, this comet is a Jupiter-class comet. Now, let me explain, and this is part of my work, that comets are captured. They're a captured entity. They were not formed with the solar system. There's no such thing as an Oort cloud. Nobody's ever seen an Oort cloud, and nobody's ever going to see the Oort cloud. It's supposedly a place where comets are born, and it was originally initiated by a guy named Oort, and the concept was that the comets would come in from great distances, so they thought, well, that must be where they're born. And the reality is that comets are objects that come in. They might have come from another galaxy. They may have come from another star system that blew up or planets blew up. You can imagine here, if two planets collided and boom, smashed material all over the place, and this stuff flies off at high velocity, some of it's going to leave our solar system. It's going to just go flying away. It's going to escape velocity will be greater than the escape velocity of our solar system and planets and the sun. And it just goes flying off. Well, some of that someday may end up in other star systems. So it'll become a comet, because a comet is not a snowball. It's a discharge of using any rocky nucleus. It's a discharge of the stellar capacitor. So comets really are coming from, we don't really know where, but eventually they're captured. To capture an object into a solar system, the celestial mechanics reality of it is you need two bodies. You need the sun and Jupiter, or you need the sun and Saturn, or you need two bodies with gravitational fields that are coupled together. One object by itself doesn't work. You're not going to capture something unless there's some sort of braking mechanism. But in pure classical mechanics, you need two objects to gravitationally capture a third object. And so Comet Honda Marcos 45P is such an object. Its orbit goes out to the orbit of Jupiter, and someday it will encounter Jupiter again, and that will change its orbit. But interestingly enough, a lot of these captured comets, Jupiter has a family of comets, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, all have families of comets. And eventually Jupiter will encounter this comet again on another orbit of Jupiter's orbit and change its orbit, and then who knows? It's a billiard match out there. We don't know. It's very difficult to predict. But anyway, this comet is a Jupiter family comet. It comes in to the inner solar system, and its closest approach to the sun is inside of the orbit of Venus. So at any rate, that's as close as it gets to the sun. And so it has a possibility of having some kind of interaction with the inner planets, including Mars, Venus, Earth, and Mercury. So this time it's going to have encounters with all of them except Mars. So Venus, Mercury, and Earth are going to have some type of encounter, and I'm going to explain all of these and the dates when these are going to happen. Its closest approach to Earth is going to be February 11th, but as it turns out, February 11th is the least likely interaction date of all of them, even though it's the closest approach to Earth. So let me go through these. December 13th, right around the corner here. And let's see, what day is that? This is the 8th, so the 5th, so that'd be Tuesday, next Tuesday. This is going to be in the evening sky. Now, remember that Comet 45P Honda, I'll just use that abbreviation, is a small comet, so you would need some fairly decent telescopic equipment to see this. But if you had cameras, now looking through a telescope with your naked eye is not going to allow you to see very much. And by the way, you have to be very careful here because you're going to be seeing these in the evening sky. As the evening sky sets, you'll be able to see Mercury, Venus, and the comet up in the evening sky. But you have to be very careful because you don't want to take a glimpse of the sun through a telescope. It'll burn your eye out. So you have to be very careful of this. December 13th, the comet aligns with Mercury, but we have a beautiful broadside view from Earth in the evening sky. Now, the comet is near the orbit of Venus when this happens, but it has a direct lineal electrical alignment with the planet Mercury. So what could we see here? We could see a brightening of the comet on December 13th, very easily predictable. And also, potentially, the tail could grow. We have seen comet activity on Mercury, Venus, and actually Earth also. We've seen the Earth's moon has a sodium tail, a very much a comet sodium tail. So at any rate, December 13th, we could see those conditions, or we could see solar flaring as the linear electrical alignment creates a discharge that passes through Mercury to the sun. So those are the potential effects. And Venus, by the way, is going to be visible in the sky, very bright, but it's not going to be in the arrangement of lineal, even though it looks like it is from the side, from our vantage point from Earth, it's not going to be in the electrical alignment. So there's no reason to expect something to be happening with Venus. But Mercury and the comet and potentially the sun reacting. Remember, Mercury is in a very close orbit around the sun. Moving on, December 26 to 29. The comet, by the way, in the scenario we just talked about, the comet is outside the orbit of Mercury. Visibly, it'll be almost as far out as Venus, visibly. But like I said, Venus is not in an electrical alignment. It's an optical illusion. Venus is actually closer to us than the comet. But in the December 13th scenario, the comet is outside the orbit of Mercury. December 26th to 29th, the comet aligns with Venus. But this time, the comet is to the inside of the orbit of Venus. Now, Venus is going to be up in the evening sky, very bright, and Mercury is going to be very close to the sun. So, possibly visible, but there again, if in the evening sky, that's some of the times when you can see Mercury. And it'll be off to the left side of the sun, the same side as Venus and the comet. So potential effects that might be visible if you have a telescope. Venus could go comet, and we've seen this before. It's a very good alignment. It's right in the ecliptic. The comet could develop a sunward spike, or the comet could flare also. So the comet could grow in brightness and the tail extent, etc., on those dates. And it's a range of about 2 days, 2.5 days, December 26th to 29th. And there again, you could see the sun responding, although Venus and the comet are quite a distance away. It's not as likely that the sun would react to this as in the December 13th case, where Mercury is very close to the sun, aligning with the comet, and could project that electrical discharge down to the sun. We have seen Mercury and the sun interact before. Okay, here's the one that is going to be most visible from Earth, from the standpoint of Earth, January 29th to February 4th. And remember, February 11th is the closest approach of this comet to Earth. So this is the one that may get noticed more than anything in this prediction. And once again, this is a very small comet, but depending on solar conditions and other factors, it could have an effect on Earth. January 29th to February 4th, possible big weather events for Earth. And so, once again, this is difficult to say. We'd have to wait until that time to see if the solar wind or any other Earth weather event contributors are in the mix at that time. But at this time, this comet will be in literally a perfect linear electrical alignment between Earth and the sun. So we'll be on the tail side of the comet. And once again, we could be caught up in that electrical discharge. So very interesting, those dates. I'm going to take a quick look here at the subsequent orbit of comet 45P Honda Marcos. And in September of 2019, it's going to be the farthest distance from the sun. And I was looking to see if it could possibly have an encounter with Jupiter at that time, and it's not. By the time it gets out there, Jupiter will have been long past that point in its orbit. But someday, if you keep cycling Jupiter and that comet through their orbits, someday Jupiter and that comet are going to have an interaction. And it has the potential to become a moon of Jupiter, to be captured by Jupiter as a moon. So in there again, that's where Jupiter has garnered all of its moons throughout history. Okay, so what are the possible effects that we might see between January 29th and February 4th? Some possible weather effects on planet Earth. And, so the closest approach, February 11th, really not a lot's going to go on. I mean, it's going to be about 0.1 astronomical units from Earth. That's about 20 million miles. So it's really a long ways away. It's not in the plane of the planets. There's no electrical alignment. It's really not an issue at that point. And it'll be above, visible in the northern hemisphere. So it might allow people to see it. And even at that close approach, which is not that close, by the way, this is really pretty far away in terms of lunar distances, it would be about 80 lunar distances, so quite far away. It might, I don't know if this would be visible to the naked eye. They're saying that it's not, that you would need a telescope even at that relatively close position, relatively close, like I say, but I'm not expecting anything major. So of all of the dates of this comet that might have potential effects on other planets or Earth, the closest approach is not one of them. So what I think is comical is everybody's running around the internet, jumping up and down, talking about this comet on February 11th, when that is the least likely day for anything to happen of all the dates I've just enumerated. And of course, nobody else has the wherewithal to go out and actually analyze these other dates that I just gave to you, December 13th, December, that's with Mercury, December 26th to 29th. And I'd love for amateurs. Now, back in the day, I think it was around 2002, there was a flurry of comets that came into the solar system that were aligning with planets, and it gave us a very good broadside view. And I had a worldwide comet photography program set up, and wow, did I get hacked. NASA shut it down. NASA then came out with their own worldwide observing to take program to take photos from amateurs, and they just destroyed it because I was looking for very specific things. I was looking for sunward spikes, and the pictures started to come in. I was 100% right, and man, they don't want amateur astronomers talking to me at all or sending me photos. It was pretty brutal, but it just shows you how worried they are about me presenting my work to the public, especially when it deals with comets. They are deathly afraid that you, the public, are going to find out the true nature of comets. And if you do, there's a simple one logic step to understanding that outer space is filled with electrical energy, and wow, we don't need oil or coal or nuclear power. We could get all of our energy from electrical sources that are passing by us in great quantity every day. And remember that that's what Tesla was doing. Tremendous amount of misinformation about Tesla. And by the way, in my paid cast series, I cover Tesla. My show last week was on the Wardenclyffe Tower, where I talk about the reality that Tesla was gathering energy from the atmosphere and driving it through the ground. He was using the ground as his distribution network, because the ground has a certain frequency, and it, as with most frequency-related electromagnetic transmission, there are high-pass and low-pass filtration. So at certain frequencies, if you understand the frequency that the Earth works at, then you can pass large amounts of current with a high-pass frequency, in other words, low attenuation, low loss, low impedance. And Tesla understood this. He was doing this in Colorado Springs. So anyway, listen to that lecture. It would be the December 1st paid cast of this month. The Wardenclyffe Tower. Oops, I'm sorry. It was November 17th, Tesla's Mind, the Wardenclyffe Tower show. November 17th. But it's in the paid cast. If you're in the paid cast, you have all of them. At any rate, the issue with comets is that they are simply deathly afraid of you finding out the real nature of electrical conditions in outer space. I was set up about 14 years ago. I was starting a project to reproduce the Tesla Tower and start to extract energy from the ionosphere and distribute it, and I realized that it's a very dangerous process because of the variability of the energy passing by in outer space. But that same energy is translated into wind. Our wind systems down at the surface of the Earth in the troposphere where we live are related to jet stream, the solar wind, and the ionospheric jet streams, etc. And they filter down to us down at the troposphere, down at the ground level. And that's the wind energy literally related to electrical energy that's passing by us every day in outer space. So that's a much cleaner form of electrical energy to harness than literally tapping into the vertical electric field, which is a very dangerous proposition because you're going to have your cities hooked up to this, your electrical grids, and you have electrical current path into outer space. You're just asking for trouble. So the wind, though, provides a tremendous amount of energy. It's very available every place, North Pole, South Pole. And for more information on that, look at my book, McCanny Wing Generator, World Energy Project. Okay, so Comet 445P Honda Marcos, and coming up on those dates. So we'll see. I'll keep track of this. And I would love to start another amateur astronomy viewing program, but I don't think it would get very far. They seem to shut down my email address, block my emails, go out and harass. They were actually harassing the amateurs who were sending in pictures. And like I say, NASA developed its own program to get amateur pictures. It was really funny because they had never, ever done that before and never thought about doing it. And then all of a sudden they're up there, oh, we need amateur pictures of these comets. Oh, man. Yeah, it just doesn't get any better than that. What I've been through in my lifetime, definitely have to write a few books about for posterity. Just a couple closing notes. The big sale ended on my webpage, but there's still 10% off on the water filters and filter elements. And this week on the paid cast, if you haven't joined the paid cast yet, please do, $3.95 per month. This week's topic, Environmental Toxins, Part 3, How to Build a Home Water Emergency System. And this is really detailed. Now, I have personally built and used all of these that I'm going to give. And so it covers a wide range of whether it's catchment from rain, whether it's groundwater, artesian wells, city water, other types of systems. Then the intermediate tanks, intermediate filtration that you do with, that you actually build in the ground. Then the intermediate tanks, storage tanks, final filtration, etc. And all of the considerations that go into these. And like I say, I have lived in remote places where I literally built and used all of these systems. And so let me just read some of the topics here that are on the list just to give you a point of view of what I'll be talking about. Like I said, the sources of water, roof catchment, tarps, cement troughs, surface runoff, initial ponds, pond water, artesian wells, and then other types of wells, sand points, and deep wells. All of a sudden, tank systems, how to filter sediment with a double tank system, whether it's, I'll show the design for cement tanks, for plastic tanks, etc. Other considerations, line pressure, how do you create line pressure in the naturally occurring water system, or how do you do it with gravity feed systems, how do you do it with pumps, with solar panels, with wind generator, 12 volt, or converting to 120 volts, with pressure tanks or without pressure tanks. I'll be talking about filtration, intermediate filtration. I'll be talking about the gallons, the number of gallons that you want per person, and the size of the tanks, and then final storage, and then the type of tanks that you would want outside or inside or buried tanks. Really extensive information on how to build a home, and not only for emergency. These are systems that you would use every day. So once again, go to the webpage, jmccsci.com. And with a purchase of $300 or more, you get 6 months free of the paid cast. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.